we've had our exam. As I said, I just got back in last night late, so I want to stop, begin grading this evening if I can. Try to have them with you, get back to you a couple of days. We come now to Section 2, the Imperial State Church, we're calling it, A.D. 323 to 604. And as I indicate at the head of Section 2, this section covers the history of the church in the Roman Empire after the period of persecution and before the complete destruction of the empire by barbarian invaders from the north. Let's begin. As I did in Section 1, I'm going to look at the big picture, sort of give you the overview of this whole, of what's going on in the world. Let's set the historical context. First of all, this is the period when we see the decline of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire has been declining for some time, but it is pronounced in this period. And I list some major factors. First of all, a disruption caused by civil wars. Civil wars were going on before, but Rome was literally torn apart from within during this period. Secondly, crushing taxes were required for the defense of the empire from the northern barbarians. As the empire weakened, the barbarians, who were always interested in moving south where the money was, where it was warm, these barbarians always wanted to go to the beach. And we had wealth, food, civilization, and we're going to see later the barbarians did not want to come down to destroy civilization. They want to raid and loot. They did that because they were barbarians, but they wanted to be a part of. They wanted to have as their own the high culture, the comparatively high culture they saw in the south. Well, as the empire weakened, they stepped up their pressure, increased their pressure, and therefore it cost more and more to defend the empire against them. There was a decline in agricultural production. Two major factors in this: there was a decline of scientific farming in the great estates, and the decline of slave labor. Christianity had something to do with this. But by the way, you read from the ancient literature, there was a great deal of what we would call scientific farming, not necessarily scientific by our standards, but certainly systematic farming, intelligent farming, fertilizing. And this was on the decline. There was an over-concentration of the population. Population began to draw into the cities, into the coastal areas, to the flatlands. And I put this in here from Tertullian, who writes his work On the Soul, and I thought you might be interested because it sounds so very modern. Tertullian here, as I point out, is arguing against the theory of transmigration of souls. He says that if we accept this theory, it must be assumed that the numbers of mankind are constant. You know, the Mormons teach and Plato taught that there were so many. In an original creation, there were a certain number of spirits born, no more, no less. And each of these comes in for their turn in a body, and then with reincarnation, more than one turn. And he's arguing against that, so you see the context. And so our information here is incidental. This could not have been written by a modern who was concerned about ecology. Surely it's obvious enough, if one looks at the whole world, that it is becoming daily better cultivated and more fully peopled than anciently. That is, that which, by better cultivated he means, lands that were not cultivated are now being cleared and cultivated, as opposed to better technique. All places are now accessible in his world. All are well known, all open to commerce. See, the frontier has been used up. Most pleasant farms have obliterated all traces of what were once dreary and dangerous ways. Cultivated fields have subdued forests. Flocks and herds have expelled wild beasts. Sandy deserts are sown. Rocks are planted. Marshes are drained. Unless Florida doesn't. And where once were hardly solitary cottages, there are now large cities. We couldn't find a house before. Now you find a large town. No longer are islands dreaded, nor their rocky shores feared. Everywhere are houses and inhabitants and settled government and civilized life. Our teeming population is the strongest evidence. Our numbers are burdensome to the world, which can hardly supply us from its natural elements. Interesting. I read an article this week that the topsoil is being depleted, and we're going to have a few, some are saying we're going to have food shortages, even in the 80s. This is what Tertullian was saying way back here in the 3rd century. Our wants grow more and more keen, and our complaints bitter in all mouths, while nature fails in affording us her usual sustenance. In every deed, pestilence and famine and wars and earthquakes have to be regarded as a remedy for nations, as the means of pruning the luxuriance of the human race. We're just going to have a few wars and famines to thin out the population, or we're all going to starve to death. Interesting, isn't it? That would be said way back then. Well, there was a decline in commerce and industry. This led to the decline of this led to economic regression. The economic situation was deteriorating. Secondly, there was inefficiency, as I point out, instability and corruption in the imperial government, an overwhelming bureaucracy that could not be controlled and which was built on bribery. You want to see something like this. Such countries as Mexico and certain Arab countries have a huge bureaucracy. Turkey is like this. Huge bureaucracy, bribery everywhere. Nothing works because everybody's interest is to his own interest, trying to line his own pockets. And Italy was like that at the beginning of Mussolini's reign. It was said of Mussolini that although he was a dictator, they said, well, the old saying was, well, at least the trains run on time. You know, in a very dictatorial way, he thinned out some of the cumbersome bureaucracy. Well, this was the problem Rome had, and America is having, by the way. Next, there was a great spiritual decline, at least from the Roman point of view. The loss of the old Roman spirit, the old official religions were giving way, and Christianity undermined the base of paganism, which supported the theory of imperial government. As I've already said, that maybe, that it's a sure thing, and it's my opinion it is, that Gibbon was right in his great work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He hated Christianity, but at least he was partially right when he said that Christianity, in undermining the political myth which supported the centralized government, that is, the emperor in his absolute authority, when Christianity undermined that, it contributed significantly to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. You can see how it would. Next, I point out that the Greek East and the Latin West were drifting apart. Keep in mind, the East is west of Macedonia and Achaia. Straight down, you have Carthage and Rome, the major cities in the west, Alexandria, Antioch, and later on what's going to be called Byzantium, Nicaea earlier, near there, it's not the same town, but this area is the east. It's where most of the people are, most of the wealth is, most of the civilization, and they're drawing apart for all kinds of reasons. We're going to see later that when the empire falls in the west, it does not fall in the east until later. And just looking at ahead so you see, kind of see where we're going. What happened to the great Roman Empire? In the east, it fell. In other words, it was weakened, it declined. It finally fell in stages to the barbarians from the north, which are our ancestors for the most part. And in the east, the church in the east, the civilization in the east, it was in decline and disintegrating. It finally fell, that is, it was radically changed in the 8th century and 7th centuries, 7th and 8th centuries, by the great Muslim invasions. And that's just looking ahead. We'll see that later. Next, we had the emergence of the Germanic peoples. The northern and western reaches of the empire had never been Latinized. Let me point out something here, and I'll use this map so I can stay close to the recorder. That won't help. We need this map over here. If you look at I'll stand over here. If you look at the lands, look at Spain, Italy, southern France, Italy. Those lands were Latinized. That is, by Latinized, the Roman culture was well established. To the north of that, you get northern France. Northern France and Germany, you see over there, and Great Britain and Scotland. Those lands were more or less claimed by the British. It was occupied at various times, although he couldn't always hold it. Recall, Hadrian had to build his great wall across the north between England and Scotland to try to hold the Picts out. But while up to the Rhine and in the northern France and Britain, the Low Countries, Holland now, the Netherlands, that land was Roman occupied, but it was never Latinized. The Roman culture never really took root. And it's interesting that when the we're going to see this into our next quarter, that when the Protestant Reformation began, the Protestant Reformation did not take, it did not survive in the lands that had been Latinized. It's interesting that the countries that remained Roman Catholic and still do, Portugal, Spain, Italy, southern France, this area, southern Switzerland, these areas were thoroughly Latinized, which demonstrates, the evidence, I think, of how closely tied Roman Catholic Christianity came to be to Latin culture, and still is. And Protestantism prospered, managed to get a foothold and prevail, for the most part, in areas that were not Latinized by the end of this period that we're looking at right now. Does that make sense to you? See, culture is tied to religion, and religion is tied to culture. Well, especially when you have a church state, as we're going to see developing in this period. Roman armies had been resisting barbarian invaders for a long time. These Germanic peoples began in 376 to really make serious inroads to the south. They crossed the Danube frontier, and within a century, they had become a dominant force in Western Europe. Danube right in here. They begin to move down, and they begin to be, instead of just wild tribes of people who hit and run, they come and they stay. They occupy areas. They begin to move down, and they have to be reckoned with. You have to defeat them or make a treaty with them. The Huns raided Gaul in 451. What's the modern name for Gaul? France. Rome was seized by the Vandals in 455. And the Vandals went on down. And we're going to look at this in detail later. I'll just mention it here. They went on down into northern Africa. We get our word Vandal from this. They raided Rome in 455. In 475, the last emperor in the West was deposed by Odoacer. His name, if you're interested, was Romulus Augustus. If I don't put this in the syllabus. This was the last Roman emperor in the West. And some date the fall of the Roman Empire at 475. Well, it was formally done for in the West, not the East. But anyway, we can see what's happening. And the last century of Roman rule saw competing figures, including Attila the Hun, succeed in destroying the high civilization of the empire. And we're going to talk about that more later. We're looking at the big picture now. There was the rise of the imperial state church. Looking at this very quickly, here's what we see in this overview. First of all, Christianity was the one vital force, and the church the one living organism in the Roman world during the last two centuries of the empire. Why did the Roman Catholic Church, when it finally came into existence, why was it so powerful? Answer, because when Roman culture, Roman society, when the Roman government, Roman bureaucracy, Roman civil system, when it disintegrated, the single unifying factor was the church. Remember, the church was in the process of getting more and more centrally organized. Did we call that? Remember? Went from the collegiate eldership to the monarchical bishop to the episcopal bishop, bishop over other bishops. Finally, with every century, the increasing centralization of power, the tightening up of the organization. It's interesting. Well, see, Rome is going in just the opposite direction. Their tight central organization is disintegrating. So finally, we're going to see if the church was about all that was left. The barbarian tribes were converted in large numbers to the form of Christianity confronting the Roman world. I put that in so I wouldn't say they were converted to Christianity as we would define it. But you see, as a principle, you can write it in your syllabus if you want. The principle is that when two cultures clash, unless one of the cultures is simply obliterated, wiped out, where there is social intercourse, where the meeting of the minds, even if one is a conquering people, The higher culture always overcomes the lower culture. Very important anthropological principle. The higher culture overcomes the lower culture. And what the barbarians adopted was not biblical Christianity, but Latin Christianity as a cultural, as much as a religion, perhaps more than a religion. By the end of the period, up to 606, the church is a state-supported church, or 604, the church is a state-supported state religion. Continuing our overview, we mentioned the expansion of the Byzantine Empire, 527 to 565, and we're going to look at that later, but just to introduce it here, what the Byzantine Empire is that Constantine, when things are falling apart in the West, remember the East was more stable? Constantine moved his empire from Rome, and again, we're going to discuss this in detail, over to ancient Byzantium, and he changed his name to the city of Constantine, which is what? Constantinople, the city of Constantine. And what is it now? Istanbul. But because he moved the empire, listen to me, because he moved the seat of the empire from Rome, which was being raided by the Vandals, was being threatened by the Vandals, the culture was disintegrating. He wanted to get over where there were the most Christians, where there were the biggest cities, there was the most wealth, there was the most stability. And he wanted to be geographic, he wanted to locate himself in the geographic center, or more near the geographic middle of his empire, and for all kinds of other reasons. He moved the seat of the empire, the capital, as we would say it, from Rome to Byzantium. And so from now on, the Roman Empire is referred to as the Byzantine Empire. When you hear that terminology, you know what you're looking at. It's the Roman Empire in its declining stages after Constantine has moved the capital to Byzantium and away from Rome. Do you understand that? So that's, from now on, when you hear that terminology, you know what you're looking at. A new era opened in the East with the accession of the Emperor Justinian. You had some expansion, some growth, the sort of a temporary reversal of the decline with the Emperor Justinian. We're going to meet again. He reclaimed parts of Justinian, we're going to see, reclaimed parts of the territory that had been lost. He reclaimed Italy, North Africa. However, when he died, the Lombards came back in and took Italy. He recodified the law, the famous Code of Justinian, in an attempt to solidify the empire. Justinian was a strong emperor. However, after Justinian, the Byzantine Empire survived by the use of diplomacy, not war, and the Byzantine Empire sort of drew in its borders. It was strong mainly because of the reforms of Justinian, and it lasted a long time. One of the reasons why the Byzantine Empire, or the Roman Empire in the East, was standing after the Roman Empire in the West had long since fallen to the barbaric tribes in the North. Okay? So you would know that Justinian sort of pulled things together. And the Byzantine Empire became known for the beauty of its architecture. You still have Byzantine architecture. You can recognize Byzantine church buildings. We'll look at that later. And it was a very high civilization. It wasn't a particularly Christian civilization, but it was a very high civilization. That is, art, literature, wealth. In the East, Byzantium, while Rome is becoming a backwater, Rome is becoming a dump. Rome is becoming nowhere. Mighty, beautiful Rome, the city that Augustus found in clay and left in marble and brick, is now going back to the hyenas and the lions and the squatters. Yes. Well, we're going to see this all. We're going to trace this all through this section. How about the relation of the church and the state in this period? Again, looking at our overview. We're sort of finished with the overview. Now we're going to begin to trace some particulars. We're going to begin to focus in a little bit. First of all, let's look at the developments under Constantine and his three sons. Under Constantine, of course, we have the end of the persecution. We all know that, don't we? He is called the first Christian emperor. We would often put the word Christian in quotation marks, but at least he was for the church. And what Constantine saw was that the church was the only thing that had anything going for it in the West. He's saying in the West now. There were two worlds, the Greek East, the Latin West. And so we see the increasing favor for the Catholic churches. By that I mean not the heretics, not the schismatics, not the Monarchians. Not the Marcionites, not the Montanists, not the Sabellians, not the Novationists, not the Donatists. Only the true church, the official church, the Orthodox church, the Catholic church. Sunday was made a legal holiday. Note this, that he made it a legal holiday on behalf of the church. This is where it began. This is the first Sunday legislation. The state gave money for the construction of church buildings. Very dangerous, you see. See, the church is tying itself to the state, and the state is using the church. And so they gave money. How would you like that? Just have the government build your church building. See, before they had very few church buildings. Only church buildings went up, we've already seen, were just a few ones that went up when the persecution let up. For the most part, you just didn't have church buildings, but now they begin to build them. Exemptions for the clergy were instituted, such as military service. The clergy, as a class now, don't have to serve in the army. They get their suits 20% off at Hart, Shafter, and Marks. Whatever. Ecclesiastical courts were recognized. We're going to look at this again, but the church has its own courts, and often they were better than the civil courts. Try and find somebody's guilty of adultery or murder or stealing. He's a Christian, because the church they would have ecclesiastical courts, and people could choose between the civil courts and the church courts. It's hard for us to imagine that, isn't it? Church having a court system that they did have. The copying of scripture was financed and encouraged by the state, and we're going to meet the famous Eusebius in connection with this later on. From this period come the early great codices, the Sinaitic and Vaticanus, go back to the 4th century. Remember that you studied this in the history of the Bible, or what's it, how it's named? You see, why does it go back to this period? Well, you see, now the scriptures are in favor instead of being in disfavor. And money is given to copy these. And so we find the great manuscripts, the great unsealed Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, go back to this period. There is increased restriction on paganism. It's interesting, within a very short period, and we're going to be embarrassed to see this, we have persecution in reverse. Whereas the pagan state persecuted the church, within one lifetime, we're going to see the Christian state begin to persecute pagans, which is very bad, but they did it. Increased disfavor was shown to heretical and schismatic groups. In return for the support given to the state, the Orthodox or the Catholic or the official church demanded that the state help them in the suppression of heretics. Bad business again. It'd be like us. We don't like the Jehovah's Witnesses, so we just call the governor and have him send the militia out and shut down all the Kingdom Hall. One way to get rid of them, isn't it? You see. Well, we said, we wouldn't do that. Well, maybe we've learned something from history, but they did. That was the kind of thing they did. I give an example here, the Donatists, the Native Party in North Africa. You recall that the problem? I hope you did. They were suppressed because they threatened the unity of the empire. That was the point. And note that the state wasn't just doing this to keep the church happy. It was because they needed all the unity they could get, and the church was the strongest thing in the empire. If the church were divided, the state would be indirectly weakened. So the state was glad to suppress the heretics, those who would divide and weaken the single strongest entity in their empire. You have in this period, of course, as we would expect, increased control of the Catholic Church by the state. This is an old principle. Whoever pays the piper, calls the tune. And in many ways, the state was forced to control the church. I give you some of the factors here. First of all, the church appealed to the state for help against schismatic and heretical groups, as we've said. And this did threaten the stability of the state. This is one of the reasons why, in their wisdom, our forefathers call for the separation of church and state. If the state helps you, if you use their money, if they help you in any other way, for instance, in the suppression of your enemies, the heretics, the schismatics, well, what are you going to do when the state says, okay, now, we've helped you, so you're going to help us? And every time, we're going to see this is one of the, this is, it begins in this period, and it's a continuing, still around today, the real problem of the state church. This is one of the real, one of the evils of the state church, as we would say from a historical viewpoint. For instance, when Hitler, looking way down the road, when Hitler said to the German, to the Lutheran church in Germany, this is what I want you to do for me. Many had to go, many went along. Why? Well, on what basis would Hitler come and say to the Lutheran ministers, the Lutheran clergy, this is, I want you to announce this in church, I want you to follow this line, I want you to persuade the people along these lines. Why? He was on solid ground in saying this. Because the clergy were tax supported. The church was in effect a bureau of the government. They'd been on the payroll for a long time, for centuries. And so, and there are many other problems, of course, but it begins back in this period. There was a tremendous influx of pagans. Once the persecution stopped, many people became Christians. And this is a very hard thing to understand, a hard thing to distinguish historically. Before, it had been a capital crime to be a Christian. Now, people, it was not only legal, it was politique, as the French would say. It was good policy. Christianity was in favor, pagans were being suppressed, eventually would be outlawed. Now, it's a good idea to be a Christian. What is true conversion? Well, hard to say. I'll give you an example. You've got this person, this young person, and they want to be a Christian. You talk to them about being a Christian, and their parents say, no, I won't let you be a Christian. Forbid you. I'll kick you out of the house. I'll disinherit you. You just can't do it. And so the person says, well, I'll wait till I'm 21, then I'll do it. But when you were 21 and they become a Christian, it was a real conversion. Some would say, well, yes, as soon as it was common sense would dictate, as soon as they were free to do so, they became a Christian. Others would say, no, it's not a true conversion. If it was a true conversion, they would decide for Christ and take a stand for him no matter what the consequences. They would have done before. Before was a capital crime. It would cost them their lives. Maybe they were who were very visible, people in high public office. They became a Christian, lose everything. Lose their homes, go to prison, maybe lose their life. As soon as it's legal, they become a Christian with a true conversion. No question. Some would say no. Some would say, well, yes, but maybe not the most desirable conversion in the world. Well, we don't know people's hearts, know what the answer is, but you see the problem, do you not? Yes.
I think that would answer that. Generally speaking, wouldn't they go through that?
Well, I don't know. It depends on what the person had in mind. Many came in. We do know that many came in because it was popular now. We know that many weren't true conversions. We can tell from the records. We know from what happened. And many said, well, it's good business, good politics. If you're like a businessman, you know, belongs to the church because it's good business. Don't care much about the Lord, but his business increases if he's known as a leader in the church.
Like modern politics.
Yeah. Like modern politics, right. We do know, however, that many of the conversions were not genuine in that the spiritual tone of the church was seriously lowered in this period. Many simply were baptized and retained their paganism, had no intention whatever of changing the way they lived or thought. They were baptized, became a part of the church, and that was it. And we're going to see the stepped-up paganization of the church immediately after it became legal. But again, it's not to say that all the conversions were insincere. And of course, there are degrees of sincerity, just there are degrees of understanding. Very seldom do people do anything for one single reason. To come now, I've already mentioned the move of Constantine to Byzantium, and Constantinople had long been known as a Christian city, whereas Rome was known for its paganism. And of course, power gravitated to the church because in the West, because as a matter of fact, and we're going to see this again, but for all practical purposes, what happened was that when the emperor moved out of Rome, moved the seat of his rule from Rome, who was left in charge of Rome? Answer, the bishop of Rome. Not because it was officially conferred upon him. Later on, the church claimed that it was. If we're going to look at the famous donation of Constantine, that it was given to the bishop of Rome. Constantine donated it. But as a matter of fact, what actually happened at the time was, regardless of what was said about it later, was that he became the head of Rome by default. It'd be like you had a church system here in Orlando that was very powerful, had schools, had a public welfare system, you know, had orphanages, hospitals, church ran them, and there was order, they had a real society. You follow me? Schools, hospitals, and church ran them. And suppose that all of a sudden something happened, there was a war, and everything quit working, and the mayor had to leave town. There was no more city government. No more police force, no more utilities. It's a disintegration of civil government. And yet here's the church, which is very powerful, very, very powerful, and they're still, they struggle, but they keep the business going. They keep the store open, as it were. Where do you go to get something to eat? Well, the church. They got an organized food system. Where do you go if you get sick or hurt? Go to the church. They've got their program going. You can see why, and the man who's in charge of this was the only man left. And we're going to see later, one of the barbarians comes up to Rome. He wants to meet a representative, and out goes the bishop of Rome. He's the only man in charge. Well, this is an introduction to this. The last thing we're going to talk about in this sort of introductory discussion is the pagan reaction to Jew and the apostate. We need to say this because we have suggested that when Constantine came to the throne, this was the end of persecution. That's not quite true. Not quite true. Julian, who was the nephew of Constantine, the sons of Constantine had been all put to death by relatives who were afraid they would come to the throne, because of a very complicated system, Julian became the emperor for a while. He was a pagan who pretended to be a Christian until he got in power. Once he was in power, he announced his real intention to go back to the glory of Augustus, to go back to the old days. And he, luckily, or about perhaps providentially, he only ruled for 2 years. He went to war with the Parthians, the Persians, the ancient name for them, and he was killed in battle. Rome never did go very far east of Jerusalem and do very well. It didn't in this case. And so luckily for the church, he died in 2 years. He reinstituted the persecution of the church. But he had a real trouble with it. Why? Well, the church was too firmly entrenched now. There's the historic church. And he couldn't pull it off very well. It just didn't work. There's a tradition that, you probably heard this, a lot of sermons, and it probably didn't happen, but it could have happened. He was supposed to have made this famous statement on his deathbed, "O Galilean, thou hast conquered." He tried to stem the tide of Christianity, and couldn't do it, and he was dead. But whether he said that or not, as I say, could have, is because, as a matter of fact, after Julian, formal paganism was dead. Now, we're going to continue to see how pagan ideas had insinuated themselves into the church, but formal paganism was dead with Julian the Apostate. Now, we're going to go ahead with discussion four, and this will be your reading assignment for tomorrow. But we're going to go ahead, because we've got about 10 more minutes. Have any questions thus far, anybody? Do you get the general picture? Do you want me to summarize it again for you? Yes, Mary.
Okay, sometimes
it's just you get the Civil War and things like that. That was taking place all over the East. Within Rome, mainly in the West, the East and West. Minor rebellions. The army insisted on appointing the emperors, and they would fight over who was going to be emperor, and it was just very complicated. We don't have time to go into all the details. Well, not necessarily all areas, but they were a continuing problem in this period. They weakened the empire. Struggles in within, internecine struggles. I'm sorry? Yeah, well, right before you had pagans who really didn't believe that Caesar was Lord. Now you got pagans who don't really believe that Jesus is Lord. Yeah, I don't think very often you have that. Good point. Well, so in the broadest terms, what's happening is that the church is becoming, that the empire is weakening for all these reasons. Okay, let me summarize it in the broadest possible terms. The empire is weakening for all kinds of reasons, economic, civil, spiritually, from a pagan point of view, especially in the West. The East, civilization is more durable and more wealthy. The pressure from the northern barbarian tribes increases. Christianity is becoming more highly organized, especially in the West. Constantine ends persecution, moves to the East, leaves the church more or less in charge in the West. And the borders are drawn in. Civilization continues for some time in the East. In the West, it continues to decline very rapidly. But the historic, organized Catholic Church, as it's called, continues to become more and more centralized, more and more powerful, because it's the only thing left. It makes an alliance with the state. The church uses the state to solve some of its problems, such as heretics. The state begins to use the church. Pretty soon we're going to see that we see the beginning of the process, and it's a rapid process, whereby we're going to wake up one day and see that you really cannot tell the difference between the church and the state. Yes,
right.
He was before, I believe. That's a good question. I can't recall this. Somewhere I probably have all the emperors in, but I don't have them here. Yes, I dealt with that more topically. You might check on that for me and tell us. I don't recall exactly the years off the top of my head. Yeah. I was dealing with this period as a whole, that's why I didn't put that in. So look at this whole package. Up to 605, 604, 604. This is an old Roman Catholic concept of the privileged clergy. Privileged by the state, still very much in the American tradition. I think it's a very bad idea. If you ask me, I'll tell you. I made it a policy when I was in the ministry, once I learned better, never to accept clergy exemptions for anything. I'll tell you why. If they take 10% off what they sell you, they'll take 50% off what you say. They will never take you seriously. That's the kind of thing you grant to your children. You are kept by society, and they will. And I don't care what they say. No merchant or anybody who ever gives you an exemption will ever respect you. It's not very much, because it's like you kind of a separate set of rules. Well, it didn't take place at all until we're not going to see the church separating again from the state until the Anabaptists after the beginning of the Protestant Reformation.
Good question. You get to wait till the next course to see that. So the whole rest of this whole big fit syllabus, we got church and state all tied up together.
Okay. Let's begin to look at the final repression of heathenism and heresy. We're looking at the relation of the church and the state and the organization of the church in the 4th century and the German invasions in this discussion. So, we have talked about the final, look at this in general. We want to look in particular now to the final repression of heathenism and heresy. First of all, heathenism or paganism. Under the emperors Theodosius and Justinian, who were strong Christian emperors, paganism finally became illegal. Constantine did not make paganism illegal. He simply put it in disfavor. If you come now down to further into this period, now I don't give you a lot of years because it's hard to remember all that. Just want you to know the general time period. Paganism became illegal. And there was a political as well as a religious motive. A series of laws were passed to disenfranchise formal paganism, that is, temple worship. The practice of priests, for instance, presiding over public affairs, that kind of thing. In 392, all pagan sacrifices or divination were made a crime, calling for the confiscation of property. This is persecution in reverse. In 410, all pagans were excluded from the army and civil office. Isn't that a switch? In the beginning, the Christians wouldn't serve in the army, at least as far as we know. And now, if you're not a Christian, you can't serve in the army. In 558, Justinian commanded baptism under the threat of capital punishment. And, of course, you can see you get a lot of paganism in the church in this. You'd be bad. And, I mean, boy, they had some great invitations in those days. I mean, they'd get them all together and they'd sing just one verse of Just As I Am, and they'd have an overwhelming response. And there's a lot of stories kind of in this period, those who were baptized with the sword arms up out of the water, and now some of those came from the period of Constantine as well, those kinds of stories. Yeah. Well, they didn't give you time to think about it, but you had, eventually you had to, it was either baptized or death, baptism or death. Paganism became a steadily weakening private religion. Formal pagan worship was eradicated. People held on to their old gods. They would held on to them privately and secretly if they couldn't worship in the temples anymore. And by the way, there are many pagans died for their faith. I have to think about that. Not very many, as the son did, like the Christians did before. Although the repression was largely an act of government and for political reasons, the church approved. That is, Roman Catholic historians were sensitive about this. They like to say, well, the church didn't start this. The church didn't call for this. The church didn't write the legislation and have the government carry it out. That's true. But the church approved. The church approved of it. They sat by and said amen. And note this. Now, see what's happening? Let me remind you that one of the primary motives for the state doing this was that the state needed a unified church to support it. And they recognized the fact that pagans and later on heretics threatened the unity of the church, and said whatever hurt the church threatened the state because you say, well, that sounds pretty desperate. Oh, yeah? You see, you might not choose to bail out a boat with a cup. you would prefer a big bucket or a sump pump. Unless the boat is sinking. And if the boat is sinking, you'll bail with anything. You'll try anything, you see. And while it may seem just very indirect for the state to say, well, we'll get rid of the heretics and the pagans for the good of the church, because that'll help us. But you have to understand that Constantine and others, they were bailing out a sinking ship. And you see, Constantine even abandoned ship, in a sense. He moved to the east. So things were in desperate straits. People do strange things when things get desperate. However, this is one of the reasons, for instance, that what I'm saying is that people, societies, will accept ideas, accept practices, accept policies that would be unthinkable in peaceful times. But when the ship's going, listen, anarchy is a horrible thing. It's a frightening thing. And when the ship starts to sink, the ship of state starts to go under, they'll accept almost anything. This is why Whenever you have anarchy, or you have social anarchy, that states are quick to accept dictators. We say, we would never accept a dictator in America. We are a democratic people. We wouldn't want one man. We would not give absolute authority to one man. Yes, we would. When the only alternative was anarchy, chaos, the complete disintegration of the social order, we would accept a dictator. And so, does this help you understand what's going on? You say, why would the state do this? Well, they were going down. And the church was not being protected by the state. They certainly had an interest in this. And they stood by and, as I said, they approved. Okay, we're going to begin with the suppression of heresy tomorrow. You'll be responsible for reading Laterette, pages 91. 91-